Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's program, E Pluribus Separation, Deepening Double Segregation for More Students. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note this call may be recorded. I will be standing by if you should need assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mr. Jamal Simmons. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining our call. You are about to hear from three really phenomenal researchers and professors, and they are going to talk to you today about the Civil Rights Project at UCLA's latest widely cited report analyzing segregation trends in the nation's public schools, E Pluribus Separation, Deepening Double Segregation for More Students. The first person you'll hear from is Professor Gary Orfield. He's the co-director and co-founder of the Civil Rights Project. He'll present findings on the national report. And then Dr. John Cassera, he's the research associate at the Civil Rights Project, and he'll be speaking about demographic change and segregation patterns in the Western region, with particularly deep impact on students of color. And then finally, Professor Genevieve Siegel-Hawley of Virginia Commonwealth University. She'll go into greater detail about enrollment and segregation trends in the South, one of the nation's largest and most racially and economically diverse regions. So I'll turn it over first to Professor Gary Orfield.
Good morning. The Civil Rights Project is a nonpartisan research center that has now issued more than 500 reports. We deal with issues ranging from school suspensions to housing segregation, from dropouts to affirmative action, including the case now before the Supreme Court. We've consistently followed the pattern of school segregation and integration over the years as a fundamental marker of equity in the United States. There have been hundreds of studies and mountains of test data and other graduation data that show deep relationships between segregated schools and unequal educational opportunity. We think that it is very important to measure as a basic test of civil rights progress how we're doing on this important issue more than a half century after Brown versus Board of Education. The schools that we're looking at across the country in the 2009-2010 school year, the most recent federal data that was available for this analysis, are different educational worlds, and they are segregated both by race and by poverty. To take one example, half of the black students in the Chicago metropolitan area, one-third of the black students in New York attend schools with 0 to 1% white classmates, and these schools are profoundly poor. Is it really reasonable for us to talk about education policy without considering this tremendously differentiated reality? So what we're doing is a checkup on civil rights in American education. This is the first report that we've issued since the Obama administration came in. What we're finding is that segregation is spreading into more and more communities, and extreme segregation is becoming more common. The absolute majority of children born in the United States now are non-white. There's been a tremendous change in the racial population of the United States. In 1970, four-fifths of students were white. In our public schools, now just over half, and of the people are going into first grade, just barely half. What we have now is that 43% of Latino students, 38% of black students attend intensely segregated schools with 0 to 1% white classmates. One-seventh of black and Latino students attend what we call apartheid schools, where there are 0 to 1% white classmates. Latino students, who are now the largest minority group, they've gone from being 5% back in 1970 to being almost a quarter of our population, have experienced increasing levels of segregation in every part of the United States. And in the West, it's been extremely dramatic. The percentage that are in intensely segregated schools has gone from 12% in 1968 to 43% in our report. We are showing that millions of black and Latino students, but only a very tiny fraction of white and Asian children, go to schools where almost everybody is poor, and that the typical Black and Latino student attends a school where about two-thirds of kids are poor. We have segregation that's been high for two decades for Latino students has increased seriously every part of the country, and it is directly related to outcomes like graduation from high school. We find the most extreme segregation for Latinos in California, New York, and Texas. For Blacks, it's in New York, California, and Michigan. In spite of declining residential segregation for Black students across the country, there's been no progress on school desegregation, largely because we are eliminating the desegregation plans that existed and succeeded in the South, where there's a dismaying return to patterns of segregation. What we're seeing is tremendously unequal schools in terms of the quality of the teachers and their experience, the level of curriculum, the graduation levels, the connections to college, and so forth. These patterns are basically being ignored in national policy and by most of our educational leaders, and we're implementing reforms and sanctions that ignore these realities and often punish the victims of segregation. What we're calling for is a refocus on this issue as a fundamental educational and social challenge for the country, which is a country where there will be no racial majority and where we all need to be able to live and work together successfully. So we're calling for people to cover these and report on these obvious relationships, stop just reporting on the exceptional schools that overcome these difficulties and talk about the basic pattern, and talk about the fact that we really do have solutions that do work in many contexts and make a difference in children's lives, children of all racial groups. We're calling for a resumption of serious civil rights enforcement. There's been some of it by the Clinton administration, by the Obama administration, but not nearly enough so far, and for a serious reusing of choice plans so that they will foster desegregation rather than resegregation, which is what's often happening now. We believe there's many things can be done at all levels of government and in thousands of communities that would turn us away from the path of resegregation towards an increasing integration of our schools and communities, and that it would have major educational and social benefits. We hope that these data will be useful to people in cities and counties and states across the country, since we've got very detailed statistics available now. So with that, I'll turn it over to the next speaker.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. This is John Cacera. In this report, we explore the demographic and segregation patterns of the West. Today, I'm just going to talk a little bit about that and give you some details, specifically in the Western region. Public schools in the West have experienced a massive transformation, both racially and economically. About 20 years ago, when gas was about $1 a gallon, there were a little over a quarter of Latino and poor students in the region. In 2009, 40% were Latino and over half were poor, which helps to make the West the most diverse region, but also the lowest white, highest Latino, and second highest poor region in the nation. In fact, in two states, New Mexico and California, Latino students are the majority. So these transformation patterns, along with many legal and policy roadblocks towards integration and equal opportunity, they've created this deepening segregation for Latino and Black students, as we determined through three different measures in our report. So to paint a picture, in the West, the average Latino student walks into school with less than a quarter of white students and over 60% of Latino and poor classmates. In fact, three out of four Latino students attend intensely segregated schools, what we call those schools with less than 10% of white classmates. This 75% is even higher than the percentage of Latinos attending such schools in 1968 when President LBJ signed the Civil Rights Act. For the average white student, racial and class percentages, they change quite a bit. Even though whites and Latinos both nearly make up about 40% of the regional enrollment, and poor students consist about half, a typical white student attends school with nearly two-thirds of white, less than a quarter of Latino, and only around one-third of poor classmates. For blacks, the average student has attended school with a declining percentage of white and middle-class students over the last 20 years, as the percentage of Latino and poor students have dramatically increased in turn. In some states and metropolitan areas, which we also explored in the report, the picture is even more extreme. For every Western state, exposure to white students for the average Latino has decreased substantially over the last four decades. In Nevada, average Latino in 1970 attended a practically all-white school, around 84% of white classmates. In 2009, less than 30% were white. In California, the average Latino in 1970 attended school with 55% of white classmates. Close to 40 years later, 17% were white. With the metros in LA, roughly 30%, or about one out of three, attend a school in which whites make up 1% or less of total enrollment. Also in the LA metro, the average Latino and black student, they attend a school with nearly three-quarters and two-thirds of poor students, respectively, while the average white student attends school with only a quarter of these students, the poor students. A similar pattern was also found in Denver, San Francisco, as well as across the other 25 highest enrolling metros we explored, but they're not as extreme. So these findings suggest that the increasing segregation and poverty concentration in the West, and thus, as Gary mentioned, the inequitable educational opportunities for black and Latino students, are due to Latino growth and the continuing lack of desegregation plans. Integration efforts, they're clearly needed. So how do we get there? Creating more and even communicating knowledge of existing high-quality magnet schools, even changing the operation of school choice plans or charter policies so they foster rather than undermine integration, even supporting diverse communities facing resegregation, with housing and education policies. These are all just examples of feasible recommendations we can implement both here in the West and in the nation to begin to reach for a successful and equitable society. And then with that, I'll turn it over to Genevieve.
Hi, everybody. Good morning. I'm going to talk about a report that goes into greater detail about the enrollment and segregation trends in the South, one of the nation's most racially and economically diverse regions and also the largest in terms of the sheer number of students being educated. One of the first things our report talks about is some really historic shifts in enrollment patterns for the southern region. The black-white paradigm that has long defined the South has shifted to what's now, without question, a multiracial one comprised of three large racial and ethnic groups, whites, African Americans, and Latinos. Latino students in the South account for nearly the same share of the region's enrollment as black students. And together, black and Latino students make up nearly half of the South's enrollment. Whites are now a minority of students in the region. We also found in the report that even though the South remains the most desegregated region in the country for black students, the gains that were made during the desegregation era are steadily slipping away. Along every measure of segregation and at each level of geography, this report shows that the segregation of Southern black students has been increasing since the judicial retreat from Brown began in the early 1990s. For example, eight of the 20 states reporting the highest numbers of students attending schools under apartheid conditions are located in the South or border states, a significant retrenchment on civil rights projects. Also, for the last four decades, contact between black and white students has declined in virtually every southern state. Across the region, the typical African-American student goes to a school where whites make up 30% or fewer of their peers for the first time since 1968, when racial statistics related to schools were first collected by the federal government. Latino students in the South were seldom included in desegregation orders and have undergone steady increases along multiple measures of segregation over the past four decades. For example, more than two out of every five Latino students in the South now attend an intensely segregated school setting, where 90 to 100% of the students are minorities. Like trends in the larger report, black and Latino students in the South attend schools defined by double isolation by both race and poverty. The South reports high overall shares of students living in poverty. More than 50% of the region's students qualify for free and reduced price lunches. But students from different racial backgrounds are not equally exposed to existing poverty. Here's an example from Georgia. Low-income students account for about 56% of Georgia's enrollment, but the typical black and Latino student goes to a school where about 68% of the students are poor. Meanwhile, the typical white student in Georgia heads to a school where roughly 40% of the students are low-income. Similar trends are reported across the region. So Southern schools were truly at the epicenter of the Civil Rights Revolution. From the 1960s to the 1980s, schools in the region experienced a massive racial transformation that brought about great increases in school integration between black and white students. Those gains lasted for several decades, even as the region experienced a rising share of non-white students. Now, however, the South is backtracking on that progress. For Latino students, the region has consistently ignored the rise in their racial and economic isolation, and in essence has turned its back on its fastest growing group of students. At the end of the report, we offer several region-specific recommendations to help reverse the trends that we've documented. These include continued or new court oversight of Southern school districts, the development and enforcement of comprehensive post-unitary status plans, and a strong commitment to pursuing voluntary immigration policies. That's it for me.
We're ready for questions.
Hey. Great. We'll take questions. Operator, Erica?
Yes, I am here. Okay, at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touchtone telephone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press star and 1 on your touchtone phone. And it looks like we will take our first question from Rich Makoto. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Matoko Rich from the New York Times. Thanks for taking my questions. One was when I was looking at the way you quote the statistics. I understand when you say 50% of black students attend a school with fewer than 1% of white students. I know that's the wrong stat, but that formulation I understand. What do you mean when you say the typical African-American student or the typical Latino student?
We use what's called the exposure index, and that takes the all of the racial compositions of every school that's attended by any student and gets an average. So that means on average, a black student would be in a school with X percent of white students in that particular area. That doesn't mean that, you know, that's universally true. It's just the average.
I see. And the other question I had was, could you spell out a little bit more about what you mean about strengthening choice policies? Because in the introduction or in the executive summary, you very clearly criticize the Obama administration for having promoted charter schools, which is one way of promoting,
yes,
quote-unquote, choice. On the other hand, what do you mean by choice, and how can choice be used to help with desegregation rather than resegregation?
Well, in civil rights, we've been through a succession of choice experiences. The first one is called freedom of choice that thousands of school districts adopted in the 1960s. And under that system, basically, a black student could transfer to a white school. They'd have to go through a lot of hurdles and so forth, but in theory, they could. It really failed because there really was no support system for it. There was no free transportation. There was no good information, and there were actually administrative problems, and the students were isolated in small numbers. And so we went later to choice systems that protected students by providing free transportation, good information, an absolute right to transfer, and so forth. And that's what we had for, you know, for decades in most of our choice plans and most of our magnet schools. Charter schools don't have those civil rights policies. They don't have transportation, they don't have desegregation goals, they don't have, you know, the kind of outreach and the rights, absolute rights of parents to come, and they are extremely segregated. Basically, if choice operates with civil rights protections and policies, it can foster integration and increase opportunity. If it operates without them, it often produces even worse segregation. So it's all about how you do choice, and we're disappointed that the kind of choice that has been least successful in producing integrated schools so far, charter schools, has been pushed in the race to the top, and magnet schools, which are a much better alternative, have not been pushed actively, although they've been helped a little bit. So we're calling on administration to put civil rights policies into charters and to expand magnets.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do we have another question?
Not at the moment. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and 1 on your touchtone phone. And we did just have Kimberly Shannon with Education Week queue up. Please go ahead.
Yeah, so you mentioned quite a few recommendations, and I was wondering if you could just narrow it down, if you could pick maybe you know, your two or three top recommendations that you choose that educational policy should be focusing on right now to solve these problems, what would be the most important issues?
We think that there should be preference in the race to the top and other policies for policies and programs that increase diversity and support racially integrated communities, which are otherwise threatened with resegregation. We think that there should be a robust revival, which is beginning now, in Justice Department and OCR enforcement on desegregation issues. And we would like to see choice plans change so that they would foster and stable integration rather than foster resegregation or intensification of segregation. Those would be three that would be really important. We think all, I really put in four, training programs for the thousands of school districts and schools all over suburbia around the United States that are becoming diverse, which have basically white faculty and administration and need help in dealing successfully with the racial change that's happening in thousands and thousands of communities.
Great. Is there another question?
Yes, we have a follow-up question from Atoko Rich at the New York Times. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks again for taking another question. So one thing that I was really shocked was as the high proportion of enrollment that is eligible for free or reduced lunch, which doesn't necessarily correlate, at least with my understanding of the absolute number or proportion of children living in poverty. And I understand that being qualified for free and reduced lunch, the bar is higher than living in poverty.
Yes.
But do those enrollment proportions correlate with the proportion of children living in those income levels, or is the proportion in public at school enrollment much higher, basically because affluent kids don't go to public school?
Well, about 90% of students in the United States do go to public schools, and the percentage in public schools is actually going up. You know, so it's basically a fact that the free and reduced lunch number for free lunch is 120% of poverty, and for reduced lunch it's 180% of poverty. The poverty level in the United States is extremely low, about half the level that Europe uses to define poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it depends on how you can conceptualize it, but the percentage of kids on free and reduced lunch is much higher than the percentage of kids on who are under the poverty line in census statistics.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's because there are an awful lot of students in the United States and families that are living near the poverty line at a level that we judge to be so low that they can't afford to buy their kids lunch at school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basic reality. We have a tremendous number of near-poor families in the United States, extremely high in the South, and
mm-hmm.
very high in California from immigration and
mm-hmm.
other changes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Great. Do we have one more question?
Yes, we have a follow-up question from Kimberly Shannon at Education Week. Please go ahead.
Great.
Kimberly,
I'm sorry, one second. I just want to make an announcement. You all should have in your email boxes, if you haven't seen it yet, the press release with the link to the full report if you have not seen that.
Thank you.
Okay.
My question is regarding the choice plans. The Republican platform right now is supporting a particular kind of choice plans. What are your feelings on that? I understand that you also are supporting a particular kind of choice plan. How do you feel about the one that is being promoted in the Republican platform right now?
Well, I haven't memorized the Republican platform, but I know it's in favor of vouchers and they typically also supported charter schools. There has been no reference whatever that I know of to civil rights provisions as a condition on choice, and Republican administrations have been opposed to that. Since I don't have the language in front of me, I don't want to act as if I know it exactly.
Right. I understand, yeah. Just wondering if you had any particular background on that, then.
Well, I think that the Republican platforms have consistently supported vouchers, and of course, the Bush administration pushed them in Washington D.C. and in New Orleans, particularly, and I think that's a non-starter. I don't, you know, we've had many referenda and other things on vouchers. It's going to be a small element of future of American education, even though the Supreme Court has authorized vouchers for private schools in the Cleveland case.
Correct. So anyone else?
Currently we have nobody in the question queue. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touchtone phone. Okay, we do have a follow-up question from Matoko Rich at the New York Times.
Go ahead.
Hi. Sorry, it sounds like there are only two of us on the call, so I hope you don't mind my dominating questions.
They just aren't asking questions.
I'm not familiar with the kind of rollback, both policy and judicially, of Brown. I don't need a whole intro to desegregation policy seminar, but I wondered if you could point out a few of the ways in which that sort of at a policy or a judicial level, desegregation has actually been rolled back.
Well, the key steps really are just a few. In 1974, the Supreme Court blocked city suburban desegregation, which really was a crippler for places like New York and Washington and other big cities that were virtually all minority already. In 3 years later, they blocked or they authorized funding for segregated schools to make up for some of the damages that were done that couldn't be corrected by desegregation in a case called Milliken 1 or Milliken 2. Then in 1991, an Oklahoma City case called Dowell, the Supreme Court said the lower federal courts could terminate desegregation orders and then schools could go back to segregated neighborhood schooling, which began to happen across the country, and segregation has increased every year since then for black students. Then in 2007, the Supreme Court undermined a lot of the existing voluntary and magnet school plans with limitations on the use of race in any way, even to foster integration. So those are the legal steps. And the policy steps were basically the dismantling of the desegregation assistance program during the Reagan administration and really the failure of Congress and administrations to do very much positive about these issues ever since, and the expansion of more segregated forms of choice. That's the two-minute version.
Right. I really appreciate it. That's super helpful.
Well, there's a book called Dismantling Desegregation.
Also,
Genevieve, go ahead.
Sorry. Also, one of the positive things that the Obama administration has done is to release guidance that was jointly issued by the Department of Justice and the Office for Civil Rights at the Department of Education that tried to clarify what school districts were allowed to do under the parents involved decision to try to make it more clear for districts what the steps were that they could take to promote voluntary integration and reduce racial isolation. And that came out in 2011.
And there are a couple of districts in the country that have really tried to figure out how to do this in spite of the Supreme Court decisions
right.
and limits, particularly Berkeley, California, Louisville, Kentucky. And I think the superintendent from Louisville is one of the ones who commented on our report, Louisville, Jefferson County.
Right.
Great. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you all for being on the call. Is there another question?
We currently do not have any further questions in queue, sir.
Great. Thank you all for being on the call. Please email me or Brenda at the Raven Group if you have any follow-up questions. I think you have your emails from Brenda beginning, and my email address is jsimmons@ravengroup.com. Our phone number is 202-466-8585 if you need any follow-up information. Thank you all very much for being on the call. Bye.
Thank you.